Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. Palestinians want an end to the war in Gaza and to talk about what comes next.
Netanyahu doesn't even want to discuss this issue.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. What Netanyahu is and is not saying on his visit to Washington.
And scandal already at the Paris Olympics. It seems one team got caught spying with a drone.
It's just so unfortunate for the players who have, you know, spent the last 3 years building up to this.
Also today, a type of mosquito that spreads malaria has migrated from Asia to Africa. A new test could quickly determine whether it's arrived in a town.
It allows you to then deploy the right type of intervention.
Plus, Japan's oldest village seeks new residents. One selling point, a mountain landscape.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us. Benjamin Netanyahu is no stranger to Washington. The Israeli Prime Minister's speech today on Capitol Hill was his fourth congressional address.
That's a record for a foreign leader. Winston Churchill was invited to address Congress a total of three times in his career. Netanyahu is the longest-serving prime minister of Israel, but experience with Washington will only get him so far because this week's visit to the U.S. comes at a moment of high tension.
Protesters in D.C. today aimed to send a message to Netanyahu that he's not welcome because of the war in Gaza. And dozens of Democrat lawmakers announced they would skip Netanyahu's speech. One of them, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York, called him a war criminal.
Before leaving Israel, Netanyahu said his goal in Washington was to shore up bipartisan support for the Jewish state. The World's Matthew Bell gets us going today.
Streets were closed and the police in Washington were out in force today ahead of the Israeli leader's appearance on Capitol Hill. An anti-war group called Jewish Voices for Peace organized a sit-in inside the Cannon Building yesterday, where members of the House have their offices. That demonstration ended with 200 arrests, according to Capitol Police. Mekhaymer Abu Sada is a Palestinian political scientist from Al-Azhar University in Gaza. He saw the news about that protest in Washington and says it gave him a little bit of hope.
I personally appreciate the voices in America that have spoken out loudly against this genocidal war in Gaza.
Abu Sada spoke with me from Cairo, where he fled after the war began, but his extended family is still in the Gaza Strip. And he says the situation there is beyond catastrophe. Estimates say nearly 40,000 Palestinians have been killed since last October, with around half of the territory's buildings destroyed or damaged. Abu Sada says people in Gaza at this point just want a ceasefire. And when the war is over, most of them want the Palestinian Authority, not Hamas, to come back to run Gaza.
But Netanyahu, unfortunately, until now, I'm not aware of any serious discussion by Netanyahu and his coalition government on the day after. Netanyahu doesn't even want to discuss this issue.
Since last fall, the Biden administration has said it would like to see the U.S.-financed Palestinian Authority return to Gaza. Israeli opposition leaders say the same.
We believe that we need to walk together or to have a political dialogue with the more moderate forces in the Palestinian Authority.
Rabbi Gilad Kariv is a member of Israel's parliament, the Knesset, with the Labor Party. He says Netanyahu's refusal to work with more moderate Palestinian leaders is a strategic mistake. It's also a good example of how the prime minister has put Israel's security at risk, he says, by teaming up with coalition members from the extreme religious right.
They want us to go back to Gaza and to control the daily life of 2 million Palestinians. This is a terrible vision. It will isolate Israel totally in the international community and will prevent Israel from dealing with the real strategic threats.
And that's Iran and its Middle East proxies. This is where Kariv, along with Israelis across the political spectrum, tend to agree with the Israeli prime minister.
Israel today is being challenged by a pro-jihadist alliance, regional alliance, led by Iran. Iran is coming closer and closer to meet a nuclear capacity. Those are real threats.
Israeli lawmaker Gilad Kariv there, ending a report from The World's Matthew Bell, who just listened in to Benjamin Netanyahu's speech this afternoon in Congress. Matthew, as you said, Israelis seem to agree on the threat posed by Iran. That was something the Israeli prime minister talked about today. What did he say?
Very much. He talked about Iran right out of the gate. He was introduced, lots of applause. He thanked congresspeople for being in what he called the citadel of democracy in this chamber. He mentioned Iran right away, and he described the regime there as a threat not just to Israel, but to the region and to the United States.
In the Middle East, Iran's axis of terror confronts America, Israel, and our Arab friends. This is not a clash of civilizations. It's a clash between barbarism and civilization. Between those who glorify death and those who sanctify life.
And Carolyn, this is something that Netanyahu returned to several times during the speech, which went on for about an hour.
Strong words there. What are the other takeaways from Netanyahu's speech today, Matthew?
He went out of his way, seemed to go out of his way to thank President Biden for all the support that his administration has given to Israel since October 7th. He said this stuff will never be forgotten. Netanyahu talked about the Israeli military, about their battlefield heroics. He talked about sacrifices that Israeli troops and their loved ones have made since the war in Gaza began 9 months ago. He also talked about the ongoing protests against the war.
Many anti-Israel protesters, many choose to stand with evil. They stand with Hamas. They stand with rapists and murderers. These protesters stand with them. They should be ashamed of themselves.
Netanyahu went on to call the protesters. He said, look, they're useful idiots for Iran. Mm. Finally, the prime minister dismissed accusations from the International Criminal Court about Israel creating a humanitarian crisis in Gaza and also accusations of targeting civilians. Netanyahu said it's Hamas that deserves the blame for all of that.
Matthew, there are ongoing efforts involving high-level U.S. officials to reach a ceasefire in Gaza. Did Netanyahu have anything to say about that?
Not a lot. He did thank the Biden administration for the diplomatic support that it's given over the past 9+ months. He said that getting the hostages out of Gaza, the remaining ones thought to be more than 100, not sure how many are still alive, but that would be part of what Netanyahu calls total victory. But in terms of the war in Gaza ending, Netanyahu is focused really on defeating Hamas, as he's been since the beginning of the war. Here's a little more of what he had to say about that.
The day after we defeat Hamas, a new Gaza can emerge. My vision for that day is of a demilitarized and de-radicalized Gaza. Israel does not seek to resettle Gaza, but for the foreseeable future, we must retain overriding security control there to prevent the resurgence of terror, to ensure that Gaza never again poses a threat to Israel.
Carolyn, at least two relatives of Israeli hostages in the audience today, they were wearing T-shirts calling for a ceasefire. They were removed from the chamber.
Before he left Israel, the prime minister said he wanted to bolster U.S. support for the war in Gaza. Just briefly, a number of lawmakers decided not to attend the speech today. Matthew, what did that look like in the chamber today?
The empty seats there are a sign of the divide in the Democratic Party, with a lot of lawmakers saying that they do not want to show support for this prime minister. Back in Israel, they say, look, this is a prime minister that needs to go. He's not doing well with the U.S. relationship.
The World's Matthew Bell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also visiting Washington this week, members of South Africa's new government of national unity. They're trying to reset relations with the U.S. that have turned frosty in recent years. The U.S. Congress is not pleased with Pretoria's overtures to Moscow and Beijing, and they're angered by South Africa's case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Now South Africa risks losing the duty-free access to U.S. markets it received via AGOA, that's the African Growth and Opportunity Act. Julian Piquet is a correspondent for the Africa Report, and he's been at the AGOA meetings in D.C. this week.
South Africa consistently argues, right, that it's non-aligned. And the U.S. Congress is saying, well, actually, we're not buying it anymore, right? We think you're too close to Russia, you're too close to China, too close to U.S. foes to be calling yourself non-aligned. Hmm. And so the trade minister was here this week, Parks Tau, and he told me, basically, they are here to understand and to listen to U.S. complaints and to understand why they are seen as not non-aligned. And if there's anything they need to say or do differently so that, you know, once again, they are accepted as non-aligned and can continue to have good relations with everyone, which is what they want, right?
What's at stake for South Africa if it loses that duty-free access to U.S. markets?
As with many countries in Africa, China is the biggest trade partner of South Africa, around $23.4 billion in exports. U.S. is less than half that, but South Africa is the biggest beneficiary of the AGOA program when you're looking at non-oil exports, manufacturing, yachts, automobiles. A lot of high-end stuff actually gets exported from South Africa to the United States. When you look at China trade, it's mostly minerals. So what was really interesting to me in his statements to U.S. officials this week and to the business community, you know, the trade minister and his deputy, which, you know, we should point out is from the Democratic Alliance, so it's the other party that, you know, they've created this national coalition, they're presenting themselves as the rational center of South African politics and saying, we're your best chance for a good relationship, so let's not mess this up. Let's really get together and see if we can work things out because, you know, if we get kicked out, then anybody who replaces us is going to be a lot less U.S. friendly.
Julian, I'm just wondering if you have any stories to share of specific people in South Africa whose livelihoods possibly hang in the balance with these decisions being made in Washington.
The investment is drying up already, and we're seeing that notably in the textile industry. Everybody is saying if you don't renew AGOA immediately, like you can't wait till next year for it to expire and then start worrying about renewing it. A lot of these companies, you know, make their orders years in advance. So you're hearing from women entrepreneurs and young people who are saying we're already hurting. Different textile factories are already closing down because of the uncertainty around the AGOA renewal.
So Washington may bristle at the role Pretoria has been playing on the world stage, taking Israel to the International Court of Justice, relations with Beijing and with Moscow. But South Africa now has this national unity government. Do you have a sense of how unified it is? And do you expect to see a change of tone and substance in U.S. relations?
We're already seeing the change of tone. And I've asked that very question to the trade minister yesterday. And his point was, we're not there yet. We're still getting our act together. I think it's been about 3 weeks. The Democratic Alliance, you know, so the white-led party that is in the national unity government now, has been less vocal in support of the Palestinians than the African National Congress. But they're not out there saying we need to abandon the case at the International Court of Justice or anything like that. It sounds like the ANC is still going to run the show here, but they are also sending that message of we want the U.S. to be happy with us. So they're reexamining at least the rhetoric.
Julian Piquet is a correspondent for the Africa Report. And now a few things you might have missed in climate and weather news.
The Earth set a new average global temperature record on Sunday, and then it broke that record the very next day. On Monday, according to Europe's climate agency, the globe was an average of 62.87 degrees. Antarctica is having a warmer winter than usual, and California hit triple digits.
And with hot air temperatures come hot ocean temperatures, which can supercharge hurricanes and typhoons. A powerful one is walloping Taiwan right now. Weather authorities say Typhoon Gaimi is packing wind gusts up to 140 miles per hour. Some parts of the country could see up to 70 inches of rain. The fringes of the storm have already claimed more than a dozen lives. Taiwan Premier Chou Jung-tai told emergency responders that the next 24 hours will present a very severe challenge.
Finally, wildfires are raging in the Canadian Rockies and Pacific Northwest, carrying smoke as far south as Colorado. 25,000 people have been ordered to evacuate the area around Canada's Jasper National Park.
And those are some of the climate and weather headlines from today.
You're with the world. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Japan is the world's oldest country. Translation, 30% of the population is older than 65. That reality impacts just about everything in Japan as more people age and the birth rate continues to drop. It's most noticeable in small rural towns where young people are also leaving for outside opportunities.
For example, Nanmoku, a mountain village about 80 miles northwest of Tokyo. More than two-thirds of the roughly 1,500 people who live in Nanmoku are seniors, making it the oldest municipality in the oldest country. I visited earlier this summer to learn both what life is like there and how the village is going all in on efforts to attract new residents. It is striking arriving in Nanmoku after driving along a river up into the mountains that basically everyone you see here is elderly. From the cafe owner to the person behind the counter at a shop with handicrafts and food to people doing road work. On the narrow main road, there's a street sign warning drivers to watch out for older folks crossing the street. Abandoned houses are everywhere. We just passed an abandoned house that looked pretty structurally unsound. Satomi Oigawa works for the village and is showing me around. We spoke through an interpreter.
At night, you can see very easily that the houses where the people live in have the light on it.
Houses without lights are abandoned.
It's easy to see.
We get out of the car at the junior high school. The clock on the front of the three-story building is stopped permanently at 3:20, around the time the last students left for good. So what happened here? Oigawa tells me there weren't enough students here, so the school building closed in March. The elementary school now houses all 20 of the village's students. Of course, it wasn't always this way. Back in 1955, when Nanmoku was incorporated as a village, its population was around 10,000, with bustling forestry and agricultural sectors. That's how 75-year-old Takayo Ichikawa remembers her girlhood here. When I was a child, there were a lot of people in the village. A lot of people worked in forestry, she says. It was bustling. It was a fun time to be living here. Now, she tells me, I feel lonely sometimes because there aren't many people here. Her friend, 78-year-old Miyoko Asakawa, has lived here for more than 5 decades in a traditional wood frame house where silkworms used to be cultivated on the second floor.
This house is over 100 years old.
The ceilings in the living room are blackened with smoke.
All the ceilings are rather black. It's because it used to be here is a fireplace.
What happened in this house is an example of what's happening in small towns all over Japan.
When I was young, 9 people lived here with the whole extended family. But now I live just with my son and me, just the 2 of us.
Nanmoku's government is trying to attract new residents. As we're driving through town, my producer, Hiro Sasso, points out a sign.
First sign is, here is the nice mountain village life. If you think of moving to here, come to us. We have counseling.
Come live in Nanmoku village.
That's right. Come here, Nanmoku village. We support your move.
Helping people move here is Satomi Oigawa's job. Like the sign says, one selling point is the nice mountain life. Oigawa takes me up the mountain to a lush gorge where a waterfall spills into the Nanmoku River to give me her best sales pitch for moving here, complete with waving jazz hands. Very rich in nature and very friendly people. Please come to Nanmoku, she says. She meets with people who find the village through a website advertising cheap abandoned homes for sale and shows them places they might like. She did that with Mana Kobayashi, a 20-something who'd been living in a nearby city. Kobayashi wanted to run a short-term rental property. A Google search for old houses in the area brought her to Nanmoku. And then I came here and I found out I really liked it, she said. So that's why I'm settled here. Kobayashi walks me around the house she started renting out in December. Wooden screens separate the rooms and woven mats cover the floor. It's really fun to live here, she says. You have a lot of human interaction that you don't get in the cities. Like neighbors always come to visit me or teach me how to grow vegetables. That kind of thing is always happening here. The city fixed up the kitchen in Kobayashi's vacation rental, according to village official Jin Takayanagi. Most of our abandoned homes need renovations, he says. Renovations cost money, and we want to attract young people to live here. They don't necessarily have money. So as a village, we renovate 1 to 3 houses per year. Takayanagi is another member of the village's new resident recruitment team. All of Japan's population is shrinking, so it's unrealistic to think we could increase the population of just this village, Takayanagi says. Instead, he tells me, they are trying to bring down the average age from 2/3 of people over 65 to less than half. If we have children, young adults, and seniors, he tells me, we'll have 3 generations working together and our village can survive. The current mayor has opened 2 nursing homes, partly to provide jobs for working-age people who want to stay here. Young people can also do 3-year stints in Nanmoku in a government community revitalization corps. So far, efforts to attract new residents have yielded modest results. Last year, several people moved to the village, but about 100 people died.
What do you think is ultimately going to happen here, say in 30 years' time?
Takayanagi pauses, smiles, and tells me he can't predict the future. The basic aim of our office is to keep people healthy and living happily, he says. That's our goal. Miyoko Asakawa, in the old house with the smoke-blackened ceilings, says she is happy here. Once a week, she has tea with several women who've been friends for roughly half a century.
I know a lot of people in this village, so that makes my life very rich. One thing I say is the population is declining very much. But the nature stays as it is. As you can hear, the nightingale is always sings nicely.
You can't quite hear it in the recording, but there were nightingales singing in Asakawa's garden as she and I spoke. Their calls echoing clearly through the quiet village.
We'll be hearing more stories from Carolyn's reporting in Japan in the weeks to come. You're listening to The World. Off the coast of Brazil, sharks are testing positive for a substance that probably shouldn't be floating around the ocean.
It surprises me that there's that much cocaine.
And sparring over language at the Paris Olympics. Those stories and more are still ahead here on The World. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. A scathing new report has brought to light a history of sexual abuse in New Zealand. An independent inquiry has revealed 7 decades of abuse of children and vulnerable adults in the care of state and religious institutions. The scale of the findings has been described as unimaginable.
About 1/3 of the people in state and church care over time endured sexual, physical, or psychological abuse. The report also found that state agencies and religious institutions, Catholic churches in particular, failed to stop it. The abuse continued even after it was reported, which makes the new report all that more impactful.
This today is historic, and that acknowledgement acknowledges all these people here, all the courageous survivors that have been courageous and strong enough to share their stories and come on board.
That's an unnamed survivor speaking to local reporters about the revelations in the report.
A group of survivors gathered today outside New Zealand's parliament in Wellington to hear the government finally take responsibility. The country's prime minister, Christopher Luxon, spoke directly to them.
I cannot take away your pain, but I can tell you this. Today you are heard and you are believed.
New Zealand has said for the first time that the historic treatment of children in one notorious state-run hospital amounted to torture. The new report finds that New Zealand's indigenous population, the Maori, suffered disproportionate abuse as well as overt racism.
New Zealand is not the only country that's reckoning with allegations of historical abuse. There's also France, Ireland, Australia, Canada, and the U.S. In New Zealand, leaders say the abuse is a national disgrace, especially for a nation that sees itself as a bastion of human rights.
As a society and as a country, we are sorry.
An apology there from one member of parliament. More government acknowledgement is expected. Here's New Zealand Prime Minister Christopher Luxon again.
A terrible injustice was done in the name of state care, and it is now the responsibility of the state to make redress, and this government will ensure that it happens.
The report also calls on religious leaders to apologize, including the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury.
This next one is a weird story. Sharks off the coast of Brazil have tested positive for cocaine. That's according to a new study by Brazilian scientists. Their research shows not only that cocaine was in the shark's tissues, but at unexpectedly elevated levels.
It's way, way too high. I mean, this is like crazy high.
Chris Reddy is a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. I asked him what we know about the case of these sharks in Brazil that have cocaine in their system.
Yeah, there's a new research paper published that looked at 13 sharks, all of the same species, same area off the coast of Brazil near Rio de Janeiro. And the sharks had significantly high amounts of cocaine and the first kind of breakdown product of cocaine in their bodies. Surprising, very surprising to me. At least 100 times higher amounts of cocaine than ever previously reported for cocaine in fish or any other wildlife. So this is a significant finding if the results are accurate, which I tend to believe they are.
And how common is it to find cocaine in any kind of marine life or any other illegal drugs for that matter?
We always have to remember there's a disconnect between often we equate harm of a drug and whether or not we can see it. One of the great positives in the last several decades is that analytical chemists have been really, really good at detecting something, even in the most trace amount. So often when I tell folks, if you look hard enough, you might find something.
So walk us through some of the consequences of this particular form of water pollution. What does it mean for the ocean and the animals that live in the ocean?
When you tell me that you want to talk about some chemical in the environment, somebody asked me about that. The first thing I do is draw the structure of the chemical in kind of my forehead, right? I immediately assemble. It's kind of a tinker tots. And then I start to think about its personality. You know, where is it going to go and how fast it might break down? Somebody asked me about cocaine. I would say cocaine, you know, likes to be in water, might go a little bit in some animal tissue and should break down relatively quickly when it's eventually in the water. It's not going to last for years and years. When somebody tells me that there's a lot in a fish tissue, that's surprising to me. And what surprises me is that they looked. And, you know, this is always one of these big challenges is that if you keep looking, we might find other challenges. So in many respects, I don't think that this is a problem, the cocaine on the sharks. But I do think it points to the fact that there might be some unusual, very high amounts being released in an area that, you know, ideally should be handcuffed.
Yeah, so whether it's illegal drugs or antibiotics or any other thing that should not be in the water getting through sewage or effluent, I mean, what steps could governments be taking to protect the marine environment from any of these substances?
Well, first of all, with proper handling in the front and the back end in terms of transport and, you know, being prescribed and the proper usage, right? So we first want to start off that these drugs are used and handled in their intended means. The next step is then to start thinking about how septic and sewage systems, how effective they are in being able to break them down. And so that when the effluent from the treatment is released into the water, we have a limited amount. But here's the challenge. These sewage systems may never be able to evolve to be able to attack every drug that might be excreted from our body. So then you have this challenge. Do you want the environmental engineers telling the drug manufacturers to design a drug that not only makes somebody feel better, but it also breaks down relatively quickly in the environment and gets taken out during sewage. And that's the big challenge.
One last question, Chris, kind of a curiosity thing. I think a lot of people are familiar with the effects of cocaine on a human being. Do you know at this point what effects it has on a shark?
No, that's not my field, but it's very clear in these research papers that it should not have any, from what's known already, any noticeable, measurable long-term effects. This is a crazy story. Something is. I imagine that the Brazilian government is furiously trying to find where this is coming in. And the other thing that is the kind of the one outlier, and again, this is only one research paper, is that when humans ingest cocaine, most of the cocaine that's excreted out of their bodies is this metabolite. Sometimes they call it BE. This is, you know, it's another chemical. It means that our body slightly broke down the cocaine. And so typically, wastewater has a lot more of the breakdown product than the cocaine. So we expect in the environment that we would see more of the metabolite if it was coming from sewage waste. But in these sharks, there was more of the cocaine than this metabolite. And that just goes against everything that we can think about. To me, that sounds like there's been a lot of cocaine. It comes out really fast, and it has not been treated by sewage. In fact, it's untreated. It has not been ingested by humans.
Yeah, I mean, given how rare these kind of events are, I imagine the Brazilian government is probably pretty eager to find out what's going on.
You know, hopefully there's some really good detective work that's either being done or being planned to be done to trace this cocaine back to this source, because it's very elevated.
That was Chris Reddy speaking with us from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. In Mexico, the agave plant is used to make tequila and mezcal, also something called bacanora, a specialty liquor from the state of Sonora. Now, one group there has started making use of the waste left over from that process, like agave leaves, to provide a new source of income for rural communities. Reporter Kendall Bluss with station KJZZ brought us this story from Sonora, Mexico.
That's the sound of a machine stripping agave leaves, separating the long, thick fibers from the green flesh. It's part of a pilot project aimed at reducing waste in Sonora's budding bacanora industry by using its byproducts.
We understand that the agave distillate production industry wastes up to 70 to 80% of their base material.
That's conservation biologist Valeria Cañedo.
I'm a co-founder and vice president of Centro de Coloración para la Ciencia y Cultura, which it means Collaboration Center for Science and Culture.
Bacanora is produced much the same way as its better-known cousins, tequila and mezcal. The plant's heart, or piña, is harvested, roasted, fermented, and distilled. The rest of the plant is discarded. Cañedo and her team want to use those discarded parts and boost incomes in rural mountain communities where the spirit is typically produced.
And that's how we created the project, which is empowerment of rural women through the elaboration of bacanora byproducts.
In some parts of Mexico, efforts are already underway to utilize agave leaves, mashed agave hearts left over after distillation known as bagasso, and other waste. There's a company making agave fiber paper for labels on tequila bottles. Others are using the plants to make adobe-style bricks, bioplastics and biofuel, fertilizer, and animal feed. But in Sonora, nearly 80 years of prohibition on bacanora stifled that kind of innovation.
I always say the bacanora industry is still in diapers.
On a sunny afternoon, Osvaldo Coronado takes us on a tour of his family's ranch on the outskirts of the small town of Matepe, filled with row upon row of agave.
Rescate a las tradiciones ancestrales.
He says he's restoring ancestral traditions tamped down by Sonora's long prohibition. It's a way to honor his grandparents and his mother, who would travel into the mountains to find agave and produce bacanora in makeshift stills hidden along arroyos and in caves in the Sierra Madre Occidental, risking arrest or even death for producing the spirit.
Es ensayo y error. Ensayo y error porque no me dejaron los papeles los abuelos.
He calls it a process of trial and error. His grandparents didn't leave him instructions for their clandestine process. And as he relearns their traditions, he's working with Senko to incorporate sustainable practices.
Eso es cuidar el medio ambiente.
Yo celebro de verdad enormemente.
Vianney del Rio is a researcher and the new director of Sonora's Bacanora Regulatory Council. In 2019, she led a pilot project using agave leaf fiber in southern Sonora that helped guide Senko's work, and she celebrates their efforts.
La historia de los agaves en México Es una historia muy vasta.
Agave has a long history in Mexico, she says, and from the beginning, indigenous peoples used the whole plant. She says relearning those practices is essential.
Sustentabilidad, sostenibilidad.
For sustainability.
Una oportunidad económica muy buena.
Rural economies, and reaffirming the crucial role women have always played in bacanora production.
La mujer era indispensable.
Now, women are the ones leading innovation in the use of bacanora byproducts.
Pues yo me llamo María Luisa Bracamontes Angulo.
Francisca Córdoba Espinosa.
María Luisa Bracamontes and Francisca Córdoba are heading up Cinco's agave fiber project.
Queremos que nos vaya bien.
Córdoba says she hopes it's a success. Both widows in their 60s, the women are working with agave as a way to bring in some extra money. And because of their love for the spirit.
Yo de chamaca, pues he trabajado. Y pues me gusta.
Now they collect discarded agave leaves and carry them to a large ramada where they cut off the spines. Then don gloves and face shields before running the leaves through the heavy machine that removes the flesh. They wash the fibers and let them dry in the sun before forming them into estropajos, organic scrubbers that can be used for dishes, cleaning house, or maybe as a miracle pedicure product. It's physically demanding work. But Córdoba says they love it. They're used to working in the heat. And if all goes to plan, soon they'll start teaching other women about creating a business out of agave byproducts. For The World, I'm Kendall Blust in Matepe, Mexico.
Kendall originally reported this story in Sonora last summer.
Mosquitoes are far more than just a summertime annoyance. In parts of the world where they spread malaria, their bites can be lethal. There's one especially dangerous mosquito from Asia, and climate change has now made it possible for it to flourish in Africa. It can be hard, though, for communities on the African continent to know if the mosquitoes they're seeing are the new, deadlier ones. Christina Rafferty is a molecular biologist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and she's found a way to help communities identify the invaders, called Anopheles stevensi. I asked her first to describe what makes these particular mosquitoes especially hard to control.
Anopheles stevensi is different from your typical African malaria vector or mosquito that transmits malaria in that it behaves very differently. Your typical malaria mosquito in Africa, it grows up and starts biting after the rainy seasons. It dwells inside and bites indoors, which is why bed nets and sprays have been so successful in, you know, trying to fight malaria in the past 30 years. Anopheles stevensi, however, is a mosquito that, first of all, likes urban settings, urban areas. It breeds in man-made containers such as buckets, cisterns, tires. It also is a mosquito that is able to withstand dry seasons. And so this mosquito can bite throughout the year. And more importantly, it lives and feeds outdoors. So those interventions we've had so far, bed nets, sprays, are not able to contain it.
So how is this mosquito changing the map of where malaria is in Africa?
So far, this mosquito has spread to about 8 different countries in Africa, most of them in the Horn of Africa. There are 2 very important countries, Djibouti and Ethiopia. Both were close to elimination before Anopheles stevensi was detected.
Elimination of malaria?
Correct. And now they are both in basically endemic status again, seeing more cases than they have in many, many years. And so if this mosquito remains unchecked and we continue to let it spread the way it's spreading, you know, there have been models that basically have stated that it can threaten to put an additional 126 million persons per year in Africa at risk for malaria, more persons at risk for malaria than they are already.
Wow. I imagine to the untrained eye, this mosquito looks just the same as all the rest of the mosquitoes that might be circulating across Africa. So you have developed a test to detect it, to know where it is circulating. How does the test work?
The way it works, it is a 1 temperature, 30-minute test where you can take a leg of a mosquito and stick it into the solution, put it at 65 degrees for 30 minutes. And then after 30 minutes, a pink solution will turn yellow if you have enough of Stevensi, or remain pink if you do not.
So this is something that scientists would be using, not regular residents.
Correct. And there are a lot of countries that employ community health workers. You know, this could be simple enough that if the field scientists have set up, let's say, the tubes, a community health worker could take a mosquito leg and stick it in there, incubate it, and then read the results or interpret them very easily.
And so if these mosquitoes are already present in a location, how much does knowing where they are help public health efforts? You know, you're not going to prevent them from flying somewhere else.
Right. So the big impact that knowing that Anopheles stevensi is somewhere is that it allows you to then deploy the right type of intervention, right? So like we talked about before, you cannot use bed nets or sprays because they don't dwell inside homes, but you can then look at larval source management. It's especially important in the countries where it hasn't been reported yet. And as soon as you find it, to be able to find it quickly, then this informs national malaria programs to be able to create interventions that are also quick and might be able to control spread this mosquito from moving across their country or to countries next door.
Christina Rafferty is a molecular biologist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
The opening ceremony may be a couple of days away, but competition is already underway at the Olympics, and sadly, already there is scandal. Two members of the Canadian women's soccer staff have been sent home after using a drone to watch and record New Zealand's squad during their practice. The World's Bianca Hillier has been following the story. Bianca, when and where did this happen?
This happened on Monday in Saint-Étienne, a city about 6 hours southeast of Paris, where some of the soccer matches are being played. New Zealand soccer staff saw a drone hovering over their training session. They reportedly stopped practicing and called the police. And Marco, this all came to light early this morning, and the Canadian Olympic Committee, the COC, says they've actually learned of a second drone incident at a New Zealand practice last week.
Well, pretty stunning. So who on Canada's staff was involved here?
One person is team performance analyst Joseph Lombardi. The other is assistant coach Jasmine Mander. They're both going home. And then there's Bev Priestman. She's the head coach. She has voluntarily stepped away from coaching the team's first game, which is tomorrow against New Zealand.
Right. Is there any indication that Priestman knew that the drone was being sent over to New Zealand's practice?
No, not at the moment. In a statement, she apologized for the incident and said,
this
does not represent
the
values that our team stands for. And the COC says their soccer staff is now going to undergo mandatory ethics training.
I mean, Canada's women's soccer team, they're the defending Olympic champions, and then this happens. What kind of reaction have you seen?
It's pretty genuine shock and disapproval across the board. There's no one really defending any aspect of this, including fans of Canada's national team. I checked in with Laura Bryan, a longtime fan who's watching this all unfold from Toronto.
I'm honestly incredulous. I think this is something that is ridiculous and obviously doesn't belong in any level of sport, but certainly not the highest level of sport.
Brian added she thinks the COC's sanctions are pretty lax and that perhaps head coach Priestman stepping back is an attempt to get ahead of the International Olympic Committee before they hand out any more consequences, because the IOC is still looking into the situation and FIFA is now investigating too.
So, Bianca, you mentioned, of course, Canada's playing New Zealand tomorrow. How do you think this is going to impact the match?
I mean, Olympic athletes need to be focused in order to win. So for the Canadian athletes to have this kind of disruption, it's the last thing they want as they try to defend their gold medal. As for New Zealand, their Olympic committee said they are shocked and disappointed. And I can imagine the team may feel somewhat violated after being watched via a drone. It could also really fuel their desire to win tomorrow. So we'll have to see how it plays out on the pitch.
You know, it makes me think of the sign-stealing scandal in Major League Baseball a couple of years ago. But with the added concern of a drone used presumably to spy on another team in a city already on high alert for terrorist activity. I mean, that does not help matters for Parisians, I'm guessing.
No, security is intense there right now, and protecting against drones, which are banned, is a big part of the operation. French Prime Minister Gabriel Attal said yesterday that an average of 6 drones per day are being intercepted at Olympic sites. And they're mostly from tourists just trying to capture the scene, but it's still a concern that we're going to be watching closely.
The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports for the show. Bianca, thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Olympics are heating up already, as we just heard, but there's another showdown in Paris, and it's been going on for a while. French versus English. There's no gold medal for the winner, but France has a lot at stake, linguistically speaking. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Paris.
9 years ago, Paris made its bid for these summer 2024 games.
Paris 2024 will be about sharing the best that we have to offer. Our city, its soul, and its passion.
That was the pitch, and of course it worked. But something about the whole process has bugged Annie Genevard all along. Genevard is a conservative member of France's parliament and a staunch defender of the French language.
Le français, cinquième langue la plus parlée au monde.
Here she is back in 2018 asking Parliament to toughen laws to protect French. It's the fifth most spoken language in the world, she said, but its status is becoming more fragile here at home. For Genevard and lots of French, the culprit is English, or English words, slowly sneaking into the local lexicon. Via platforms like Netflix. And popular music. But for proof, the French defenders say you don't need to look any further than that Olympics campaign.
Paris 2024. Made for sharing.
Made for sharing. That was and is the official slogan in English. Genevard insists this was a mistake and that on French soil, French should reign. A few weeks back, Parliament agreed. It passed a non-binding resolution calling on Olympics organizers and promoters to stick with French first. That means slogans, ads, and announcements in the language of Voltaire, if you please, along with the names and terminology around sports themselves. Lots of people seem to like the idea. On the popular French TV talk show Linda, host Linda runs through English terms to be checked at the door. Take breakdancing, born in the U.S. and making its Olympics debut in Paris. In English, they call the competition between dancers battle, she says. We French prefer the term défi, which translates as challenges. Next up, skateboarding. There are two choices.
Alors, les Français ont déjà proposé glisse urbaine.
We French have proposed glisse urbaine, or urban gliding, Linda says. But our French-speaking friends in Quebec, Canada, suggest planche à roulette. In English, that'd be a plank on wheels. I take that term out for a spin around downtown Paris, where I meet visiting American Rocky Shelton from Southern California. He's come for the games.
What's his favorite sport?
Oh, probably for me, track and field. That's what I like for the Summer Olympics in particular.
Okay. What about the plank on wheels?
The plank on wheels?
Le planche à roulette.
La planche roulette.
Clearly, little traction there, but who's to blame Rocky? These days, the linguistic infiltration seems to be moving in just one direction, from English into French. Even Tony Estanguet, the head of Paris 2024 and 3-time French gold medal winner in slalom canoeing, he peppers his public comments with anglicisms.
Il y a des offres famille également pour 2 billets adultes.
Des packages.
In this interview on French TV, both the journalist and Estanguet slip in the English word package when discussing tickets for families. Paquet is the French term. Is all of this linguistic death by a thousand small cuts or hyperbole along the Seine? Most assuredly, neither. And France does already have laws on the books to protect its language. Government publications must be in French and 40% of music on the radio, too. The 1994 law that set that percentage is called the Tout Bon Law, which over time earned the nickname the All Good Law. That's the translation in English of Tout Bon if you pronounce it phonetically. All good. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Paris.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.